ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
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 नारायणं नमस्कृत्य देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीयजेत्। मुखाकृतोति वाचालं पङ्गुलङ्गायिते गिरिं यत्कृपातमहं वन्दे श्रीगुरुं विनतारिणं परमानन्दमाधवं श्रीचैतन्येश्वरम्। We are reading from 69th verse. Sadvaika nishte manasi Bhagavad Parshvavartini Tamas Chandramasi Vedam Uparajava Bhasate Sadvaikanishte manasi Bhagavad Parshvavartini Tamaschandramasi Vedam Uparajavavasate. Translation by His Divine Grace Shalaisi Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Krishna consciousness means constantly associating with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In such a mental state that the devotee can observe the cosmic manifestation exactly as the Supreme Personality of Godhead does. Such observation is not always possible, but it becomes manifest exactly like the dark planet known as Rahu, which is observed in the presence of the full moon. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. It has been explained in the previous verse that all desires on the mental platform become visible one after another. Sometimes, however, by the supreme will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the whole stockpile can be visible all at one time. In the Brahma Samhita, 5th chapter, 54th verse, it is said, Karmani nirdahati hintu cha bhakti bhajan. When a person is fully absorbed in this connection, darkness occurring before the full moon, the lunar eclipse, can be explained as being another planet known as Rahu. According to Vedic astronomy, the Rahu planet, which is not visible, is accepted. Sometimes the Rahu planet is visible in the presence of full moonlight. It then appears that this Rahu planet exists somewhere near the orbit of the moon. The failure of modern moon excursionists may be due to the Rahu planet. In other words, those who are supposed to be going to the moon may actually be going to this invisible planet Rahu. Actually, they are not going to the moon, but to the planet Rahu. And after reaching this planet, they come back. Apart from this discussion, the point is that a living entity has immense and unlimited desires for material enjoyment. And he has to transmigrate from one gross body to another until these desires are exhausted. No living entity is free from the cycle of birth and death unless he takes to Krishna consciousness. Therefore, in this verse it is clearly stated, sadvaika nishte, that when one is fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness in one stroke, he is freed of past and future mental desires. Then by the grace of the Supreme Lord, everything becomes simultaneously manifest within the mind. In this regard, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur cites the example of Mother Yasoda's seeing the whole cosmic manifestation within the mouth of Lord Krishna. By the grace of Lord Krishna, Mother Yasoda saw all the universes and planets within the mouth of Krishna. Similarly, by the grace of the Supreme Personality Godhead Krishna, a Krishna conscious person can see all his dormant desires. At one time, and finish all his future transmigration. This facility is especially given to the devotees to make his path clear for returning home back to Godhead. Why we see things not experienced in this life is explained herein. That which we see in the future expression of a gross body, that which we see is the future expression of a gross body or is already stocked in our mental stockpile. Because a Krishna conscious person does not have to accept a future gross body. His recorded desires are fulfilled in a dream. We therefore sometimes find things in a dream never experienced in our present life. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta Swami translation purport to the Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, 29th chapter, 69th text. So here's an interesting phenomena about dreams for devotees. Someone may experience things in their dreams which are meant to just clear away all of the recorded desires very quickly. It's an interesting point here that normally people, because they're taking one birth after the next, so there's a whole sequence of desires that they have accumulated. Maybe now all the desires get exhausted in this one lifetime. So it's like already kind of a person is preparing what his next life is, next lives are going to be. So, you know, it's just like somebody's already like gets over depressed or hopeless. So, okay, this life, I couldn't do this, I couldn't do that, I couldn't do the other thing. So the scope for doing that may be given to them in the next life. So all these kind of desires are actually creating what the future birth is going to be. For somebody who's practicing Krishna consciousness, they don't have a future birth. They're going back to Godhead. So this whole stockpile of desires can be dumped on you all at one time. Whoops. Sometimes when devotees are chanting, then they know they so many new things they didn't even think about, either their dreams or thinking. Sometimes so many desires are coming up. It's just like it's cleaning house. Someone used the example, you clean the floor, the dust comes up. But here it gives us even a more profound understanding that actually it's just empty out all the stockpile. You can, if you can reject the desire, if you can renounce it, you don't have to go through it. As the desires come up, one after another, you say, no, that's useless, that's bogus, forget that one. Okay. That one's not cool. Then you're left with just the ones that you have, you're not able to let go yet. Well, that one, maybe. That one might work for me. That'll make me happy. So this lifetime is for us to get rid of the stockpile of all our desires. Hopefully, by practicing pure devotional service, we can quickly eliminate most of the desires and hopefully all of them. And there's a few desires that we're not able yet to just, we think, well, I need to experience that one. Just, it's difficult without experiencing that. And for most of these desires, there's a possibility of doing it in such a way that it won't hamper our spiritual progress significantly. We can do it and dovetail it in Krishna's service, so to speak. So then, one way or another, we work through our desires and clear the stock. We have this mental stockpile. Otherwise, we have to experience it all. And the problem is, while you're experiencing one desire's fulfillment, then it usually is a prelude for a new desire. That wasn't really what I wanted. What I really want is a little different. I think this will work better, you know. Then new desires come up. So as we become more in tune with Krishna, and we start to see the material world from a totally different perspective, then we can clear away so much stockpile of material desire. See, this is just an entanglement. This is not going to make me happy. Or this is not useful. Some things we don't do it because it makes us happy, but we do it because it's a better situation for us to serve Krishna. In material life, people always try to decide things probably because it makes them happy. But some people do things like when we go to university, not because going to university makes them happy specifically, but because they are looking forward to a better income in the future, or a better career, or some kind of a better facility for their life. So like that, in our devotional service, some things we do because we know that it's better for us, even if we don't immediately like it. Sometimes you hear devotees say, well, I stopped chanting. Why did you stop chanting? Well, I wasn't getting a taste. If you don't always get an immediate taste, then you shouldn't do it, right? But that doesn't make very much sense. Like Prabhupada said, explained, it's like somebody who has jaundice. If they eat sugar, it doesn't taste sweet. But taking sugar candy is a cure for it. Jaundice is a liver disease. So by taking sugar candy, then that's good for the liver. And although initially it tastes bitter to the person who's had jaundice, by taking it, then gradually the real taste comes out and it tastes sweet. The only reason we don't have a taste when we're chanting Hare Krishna is because somehow we've either covered by too much illusion, or we've committed some offenses. And because of the offenses, we're not getting the taste. Just like we chant every morning when we do the 10 offense, they chant the little verse from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. How does that go? Bahu Janma Kari. You can do many, many births, millions of births of hearing and chanting, but you won't get love of Krishna if you're committing offenses. So someone may say, I don't have a taste, but maybe you have offenses, and that's why you don't have a taste. Sometimes we hear criticism of Vaishnavas, we hear offensive things about Krishna or something, and we don't deal with it properly, and so therefore we accumulate offense, and that covers our taste. The one cure for offense is to just constantly chant, and that clears away offenses. So maybe if we know that we've committed an offense, then we can also deal with that specifically. I can go to a Vaishnava and beg for forgiveness. Like Lord Chaitanya is the most merciful. But when it came to offenses to Vaishnavas, he was very serious. It was like that time when okay, Janaki, thank you for coming. Hope to see you later. There was this one Brahmin called Chapal Gopal, and he was a worshipper of Kali. He was doing tantric. In some parts of the world, tantra has become very popular now in the West. Tantra is known as also black magic. There's different kinds of tantra, but when we say tantra, we say what we're doing also is a pure tantra, but it's we don't usually call it a tantra, but it's also tan means the body and tra means to deliver. So to really be delivered by using your body in God's service, it's the real purpose of tantra. But people have used it as a, they also use a kind of a, using their body for worshipping ghosts or worshipping some subtle entities and getting some kind of very limited mystic powers from the ghosts, like so voodoo, macumba, in India the black tantra. It's popular because people, you know, do a charm for me. I want this girl to fall in love with me, but she doesn't look at me, you know. Or I want, you know, they do things, you know, like, this person is causing me trouble. Please make him go crazy or make him. So they stick a bunch of ghosts on the people. It's like the voodoo, then they put them. So he was doing this kind of tantra. And for tantra, then, they worship, they use tamasic worship and worship the destructive form of Durga, the material energy, like Kali. Sometimes they offer wine and meat to the ghosts. She is doing all this kind of thing. So these type of people, generally they're addicted to illicit sex, and the people that go to them are also generally pretty low life. But sometimes they get big clients. So he was into this whole thing. So he was, at that time, the tantra was very big, and demigod worship was very big in Navadvipa. Because it looks like it's religion, but it's actually a sub-religion. It doesn't really relate with serving God at all, directly, but indirectly. So he was doing this type of worship, and he was envious of why Srivas was chanting Hare Krishna in his house and not letting anybody in. They wouldn't let anybody in while they're practicing devotees. So then he thought, I'll do something to discredit Srivas. So in the night he took goat's blood and painted it all over his door and around the gate, this garden door, put a big tray with intestines from a goat and a skull, a head of a freshly slaughtered goat, and different articles for worshipping the goddess. A big tray, put it in front of his door. So in the morning when Srivas opens his door, blood everywhere. And immediately he figured that somebody's like trying to play a, you know, Halloween joke on me or something, you know. So some Brahmins are walking by, looking, what's that? And I said, hey, look it. No, I'm worshipping the goddess. See, look, I'm doing all the black magic stuff. And then they say, oh, this is horrible. Who did this to you? I mean, everyone knows that Srivas was a pure Vaishnava. He would never do these things. So it didn't have any, didn't have a slightest bit of effect on Srivas' image or anything. People didn't believe it. So then he called some cleaners to clean up the place and sprinkled some Ganges water around it, purified it. So it didn't have any real effect on Srivas. But then Chapal Gopal, because he offended such an exalted devotee of the Lord, he came down with leprosy. In those days, they didn't have that cure for leprosy, the heavy antibiotics and things they give nowadays. So if you had leprosy, it was practically became an outcast, to live outside of the town. Leprosy is when the airs don't go to your body. According to Ayurveda, there's the airs in the body, and that facilitates the circulation. But then if the airs can't go, because then the circulation doesn't go to part of your body, then the body just starts to rot, decompose. So I don't know exactly what the Western medicine described, but your body is decomposed. I think they say the same thing, but they just don't know about airs in the body. And the circulation doesn't go there. That's why, like, neem is considered one of the cures for leprosy, because it facilitates the circulation. It moves the airs around in the body. And that's another topic. So anyway, Chapa Gopal was there for a long time, I mean years, and he was suffering like anything. So one day, Lord Chaitanya and his associates were going by the Ganges side, outside the city, and then they happened to come across Chapa Gopal. When he saw Lord Chaitanya, he fell at his feet and he said, "Lord Chaitanya, I'm a great sinner, I committed so many offenses. You please forgive me." And then Lord Chaitanya said that he became really heavy. Nobody ever saw him that heavy. He was usually very merciful, kind. This time he was very heavy. He said, "I can't forgive you. You offended the devotee. You have to ask the devotee for forgiveness, not me. Because of your offense to the devotees, you're suffering in this life and you're going to be suffering in the next life. Probably burning in hell." And the guy was screaming, no, but I don't want to know. Please forgive me." So you got to get forgiveness from Srivas. So then the devotees saw a witness. They said, "Well," they really felt compassion. The person's very repentant. They went to Srivas and they told him, unless you go and forgive Chapa Gopal, he's not going to get delivered. Because Lord Chaitanya says he offended the devotee. "Devotee? I'm not a devotee." Shiva said, "Who am I? I'm the most fallen soul. I'm not a devotee at all. I have no good qualifications. Who am I to forgive? I can't even be offended. I'm lower than a worm. How can I be offended? Because I'm not even a devotee. I'm worse than anybody." Yeah, the devotee said, "That's what you think. But unfortunately, Lord Chaitanya thinks you're a devotee. And Lord Chaitanya is not going to give his mercy to Chapa Gopal unless you forgive him." So they have to use like reverse psychology. "So you want to be the cause of Chapa Gopal suffering? No, I don't want anybody to suffer because of me. No, how could that be? No." "Well then, because Lord Chaitanya thinks you're a devotee, even you don't think you're a devotee, but he thinks you're a devotee, and if you don't forgive him, he's going to suffer. So you're going to be the cause of his suffering unless you go there and forgive him." Okay, I'll go. So then he went with the devotees and they found out Chapa Gopal. And Chapa Gopal, he fell down at the feet of Shiva's and grabbed his feet and begged, "Please forgive me. I committed a great offense against you. You are a sinless person. And I, without any cause, I have tried to insult you and I'm suffering so much. So please forgive me." So then Shiva said, "Please, Krishna, forgive him for his offenses." No sooner did he say that, and miraculously, Lord Chaitanya just appears there and picks up Chapa Gopal, embraces him. And then Chapa Gopal is cured of his leprosy just by the touch of Lord Chaitanya. Not only that, but his limbs that were half eroded, whatever, half rotten away, they were restored. But that doesn't happen, even to take the best cure. So, and this way, Champa Gopal, he became a devotee also of Lord Chaitanya. Sometimes Lord Chaitanya have to be heavy to get someone to act. Probably if he hadn't said that, then Srivas would never have gone and taken the trouble with that thought, you know, oof, he was so humble. But it teaches us a lesson that it's very serious to offend the devotees. So there's ways of avoiding offenses. Sometimes people just say, oh, I've been offended, and they've not been offended. I mean, they may feel offended, but it may not be an offense. Offense, it comes like if someone does morja dalangan, it goes over the decorum, over the respect. The Prabhupada said sometimes somebody wanted to jump over the guru, or someone that chastises his guru for no reason. But that doesn't mean that though someone made a young devotee may tell an older devotee, you're a maya, you're a nonsense, this is something that would be offensive. But maybe the person's in maya, that doesn't mean. But it's not the position of the young devotee to say, you're in maya. But there is a facility that a young devotee could ask the person a question, and that wouldn't be offensive. And I say, you're a very senior devotee, I look up to you as an example, and when I see you doing this thing, a doubt comes in, you know, could I ask you a question? Okay, what do you want to ask? See, sometime I see you, you know, doing this particular thing, and I just wonder whether I should follow that example too. Is this the right standard or not? Or is this what we're supposed to do? Because I heard from this other devotee we shouldn't do that, but I'm so just a little bit bewildered. If you could clear away doubt for me, you know, then, you know, you didn't say anything offensive. Just ask the question. In India, they're really expert. That sometimes the words come up, Maharaj, could I just ask you a question? I mean, you won't take offense, right? Then you know, uh-oh. There's a setup, you know. It's like the 1-2. But that's the etiquette. That way, I was with Srila Prabhupada once he went to visit the brother of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who was staying at the birthplace of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And Srila Prabhupada really sincerely wanted to develop Bhaktivinoda Thakur's birthplace. Because Bhaktivinoda Thakur is so great. I mean, he had a vision about spreading Krishna consciousness to the West. In the British rule in India, he was publishing books for the British and for the, sending them to McGill University and different universities around the world. And about Lord Chaitanya, predicted Krishna consciousness would spread very quickly to the West. So many things. So he's very great visionary and great liberated devotee. But you cry if you see the condition of his birthplace. You really literally cry. So Srila Prabhupada had gone there several times. Every time I went with him. And proposed different things. So there was like just negotiating how he would do something joint management of it, and some things where it could be developed. But to no avail. So one time they called him there and they thought that maybe something happened, but and nothing happened, and Prabhupada got very impatient. So he started very vehemently questioning this brother of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, that if someone can't do something for Krishna, and there's somebody who can do it, but they don't let him do it, But isn't that sinful? If you can't do something for Bhakti Vinod Thakur, or there's somebody who can, but you don't let that person do it, isn't that sinful? So he asked a very pointed question about, I forget, 3-4 times. Quite intensely. There was like a big, you know, silence. And he left. Sunitoy commented to me afterwards, he said, actually, because he's my senior, he's my brother, you know, like my guru, so he's like my guru in one sense. Worthy of respect like my guru, something like that. So, but therefore I just asked as a question, because as a question it's not an offense. He was really upset. So like that, well, Srila Prabhupada, we would continually learn things practically. One time Srila Prabhupada, he said that he had a dream. He said it was a very heavy dream. He said he was taken on a ride to hell. And he was just like, saw so many horrible things, just, and he couldn't wake up. It was just like, he was locked in like a motion ride or something, you know, until it's over, he can't get out. And, but he said this was because they had taken so many disciples who are doing sinful activities. That sometimes the guru has to suffer through dreams. Now here it talks about disciple or devotee suffering or experiencing their karmas being like in a dream. And so that's one way just to experience something and not have to go through the whole gross experience of it. It says, so he also said similarly a guru may have to sometimes experience suffering because of the sinful activities of our disciples in a dream. I had one heavy dream like that, but I don't know which category it's from. Clearing my own karmas or the from the disciples. That's another. The point here is that Krishna consciousness is basically clearing house. It's like you see sometime on these shops, all must go, liquidation. Liquidating all our karma. You can liquidate your karma also by doing sacrifice. Like I think I explained here once how the Buddhists, they don't have sacrifice, so the only way they have a liquidating karma is by suffering, experiencing. So it's that's why it takes many births to get nirvana for most Buddhists. If at all, I get it. So, but in devotional service, like by chanting, by deity worship, by taking prasadam, by devotional service, one's also wiping away so many of the accumulated karmas. So it's not that we have to experience all of the karmas. We can clear house through the devotional service, through clapping our hands in kirtan, through various things. But some of the karmas we may have to experience. So then there's also for devotees, so Prabhupada explained, one time he cut his finger, like one drop of blood came, and then he said that this, I probably should have got my head cut off. But instead I just had to get my finger cut. And Krishna takes a token, suffering to clear off some karma. Someone may break their foot, they should have, you know, died in the accident, but instead it was just okay, they broke their foot or they sprained their ankle or something. We get a little suffering as a partial experience and wipes off a much bigger karma. So there's various ways that we can get rid of our karma. What the devotee is doing is building his or her spiritual body while they're practicing Krishna consciousness. So then, if you this is the devas and higher planets, they can actually see the devotee's spiritual four arms or two arms, depending where they're headed. With your strap, it looks like four arms. Yoga Nishinga has a strap like that. Yoga Nishinga, he meditates. It's the Vedic. You ever seen Yoga Nishinga, Didi?
No.
He has a strap around his back and then over the knees for meditating for a long time with his back support. In Malkote in South India and Karnataka. That's the famous yoga Nishinga Deity. So Prahlad was trying to meditate and he was having difficulties, so Nishinga said, "Look, you're not doing it right. This is how you have to meditate." And he went in yoga posture and he had a strap like that and showed Prahlad how to meditate. Then after that he took the Deity form. So the Deity is still there in yoga Nishinga. In fact, I think one of the covetous I have is from Yoga Nishinga. This one over here. They give out covetous there to the devotees. So that, so this is more high tech, that's all. So when we do preaching to people also, that's how we can get rid of offenses. When Haridas Thakur was asked by one lady, isn't it better to do mental chanting than out loud? And like, her logic was that out loud is kind of gross, and mental is more subtle. So if you're mentally chanting, subtle is better than gross. But Haridas Thakur, sometimes our logic doesn't fall through. Sometimes we try to understand spiritual life logically, but it may sound good, but it's not accurate. That's why we have to learn Krishna consciousness from the Guru Parampara, from the scriptures, not from just our speculation. She was speculating like that. But Haridas Thakur explained that no, it doesn't work that way. That when you chant out loud, because the insects and the grass and the birds and the people and so many living entities hear the mantra. Therefore, because they're hearing the mantra, they're getting spiritually benefited. So because you're helping other people, that counteracts offenses you've made to harm other people's spiritual progress. So therefore, loudly chanting is 100 times more effective than mental chanting. So, if loud chanting is more beneficial, then what about like Brihat Madranga? Book distribution, prasad distribution. I heard there was once like a drug dealer wanted to give a donation to Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, "We don't want drug money." But they kept insisting, and they said, "We want to give some money." I thought to just, he said, "No, we don't want. But if they spend their money on prasad distribution, they can somehow spend it on prasad distribution, and by that they can counteract the harm they bring to people, or do to people, to their illicit." So that way, somebody can counteract having done harm for other people by helping people. Madai was very much repentant. Came to Nityananda Prabhu and he said that I offended you, I hit you with a wine bottle. So I want to beg your forgiveness. But Nityananda said, you know, I didn't take any offense. Because I love you. For me, you're like a child, a little baby, like the other babies are in the mother's lap. So the baby hits the mother, you know. Mother doesn't take any offense. You take offense? So Lord Nityananda says like that for me, you know, like hitting me, little baby. Of course, this guy, a passionate drunk guy with a wine bottle, smashes him on the head. It's like a baby. This Nityananda Prabhu's compassion. Well, Chaitanya didn't take it like that. But Nityananda, I mean, Mara, I really wanted to get forgiven. So then he said, well, must be some way that I can. Well, I committed offenses to other living entities. I mean, I was a criminal. I was beating up people, robbing them. I was molesting people. So I was a really bad person. How do I get rid of all the offenses I committed to other living entities? So then Nityananda Prabhu said, well, you could build a bathing ghat into the Ganges. If you, by facilitating people to worship the Ganges and go to the Ganges, then you'll be helping them in their spiritual life that will counteract all the harm you did to people. So then Madai, he took a, you know, a little hoe and gathered stones, and then in the, he had to do these things in the dry season. It's very hot then in India. But that's the time when the river is lowest. You have to build the step into the river when it's at the lowest point. So that's at the very end of the hot season. So he's there toiling in the hot sun, building this. He built the biggest ghat in Navadvip. It's famous, known as Madai Ghat, as his public atonement for all this harm he had done to people. His social service, like community service for the community disservices he had done before. And so in this way he got purified. So by preaching, by distributing prasadam, by giving Krishna to others, we can also get forgiven for some offense we've done. Not that preachers should think, well, can I be more offensive? I'm going to preach anyway. We should avoid offenses best we can. But by giving, by helping other people in any way, that also goes to our credit. So Krishna consciousness, from one perspective, I mean, there's many different perspectives. One, from the karmic perspective, which this verse is largely focused on, is to detach ourselves, to get rid of all our accumulated karmas, not to accumulate any new ones, to act without doing any karma, to do everything for Krishna so that we don't do any new karma, and to avoid offenses, and to get rid of all of our offenses that we may have committed to living entities or to other devotees or to guru or anyone, and to avoid accumulating any offenses. Sometimes devotees, when they first come, they're not offensive because they haven't had any association with devotees. So they get so much enthusiasm and bliss, and they start noticing this one and that one, and they start becoming offensive, and then they lose their taste for chanting. They why? It's not the same anymore. The process doesn't work. The process works perfectly, but then we have to avoid offenses. बहुजन्म करी चली सावन कीर्तन तब कृष्ण तब नहीं पाए कृष्ण प्रेम दन. It's only half the verse, actually. The only chant I know is Australia, so I didn't memorize it. That particular. We don't get love of Krishna if we do offenses. Of course, that's the miraculous thing, that if you chant Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasari Gaur Bhakta Vrinda, even if someone's a little offensive, but if they chant a Panchatattva mantra, then by Lord Chaitanya's mercy, he doesn't accept our offenses. He's so merciful, like Nityananda didn't accept offense. So then our chanting becomes offenseless by Lord Chaitanya's mercy. It's like virtual offenses. Even though it's offensive, it's actually virtually offensive. Offenseless by Lord Chaitanya's mercy. So then by chanting, we actually experience transcendental bliss. Much more than we should. Because Lord Chaitanya is not taking our offenses. Even some upper sampradayas who have gone off from the path of Lord Chaitanya's strict process, they chant different concocted mantras like Nitai Gaurati Sham Hare Krishna Hare Ram. But still they're feeling some spiritual happiness because they're saying Nitai Gaur. And Nitai Gaur, they don't take offense. Lord Chaitanya was upset because he offended Srivas, but he didn't personally take offense. He took offense because of his devotee being offended. And as soon as he was forgiven, me, they forgave also. So as we become more Krishna conscious, we start to see things from Krishna's point of view. From the spiritual point of view, then the material world, you don't see it as something that we want to enjoy. The material world is Krishna's energy. We want to use it for Krishna's service. You see a beautiful mango, something nice to offer to Krishna. Of course, the next verse we're going to discuss tomorrow, so we won't get too much into it, but it says, as long as there exists a subtle material body composed of intelligence, mind, senses, sense objects, and the reactions of the material qualities, the consciousness of false identification and its relative objective, the gross body exists as well. That's the sneak preview for tomorrow. But as long as we have a material body, as long as we have all the false ego and material body, so there's going to be some identification. Otherwise, we couldn't exist in the material world. But as we get, we can get flashes how we're not the body. We can see things from another perspective, and even while we're in the body, we can gradually see things in such a way that we don't look upon the material world just for our enjoyment anymore. Don't be detached. And we can train our mind to be detached by seeing, when we see things, think that how I can use this for Krishna. Prabhupada was, we were all young at that course when Prabhupada was preaching to us. He was saying, you know, if you see, maybe a girl sees a handsome boy, a boy sees a young girl, there's a natural attraction, but then you think, oh, this would be a nice person to be a Krishna devotee. Rather than the material thought, it must be a nice person to enjoy with, this would be a nice person to help to become a devotee. See some edible, this would be nice to offer to Krishna, a nice flower, right? Some people just grab the flower and that's great, you know. Or a devotee, pick the flower, offer to Krishna, then you get ready. So gradually you can train the mind to do things for Krishna, and then you do that long enough, it becomes second nature. And you don't, then eventually you start seeing things from Krishna's point of view. Krishna doesn't see the material world as to enjoy it. He only wants to enjoy with his devotees. He enjoys with the spiritual energy, not with the material energy. So when we become so much in tune with Krishna, we want to serve with Krishna, we want to relate with Krishna. We're not interested in just enjoying the material world. As long as we have a body, there's a survival amount of material interaction we have to have. But that's not the goal of our life anymore. That for survival we need for peace of mind. But actually we need to start developing our relationship with Krishna. That's why what brings the devotees back to Krishna. Then they don't need a material body anymore. So they don't need the karmas. So see how everything is kind of tied in. So we hope that everyone is very successful in developing their spiritual bodies. Eliminating all their karmas. And becoming completely in harmony with Krishna. Hare Krishna. Is there any question? Well, I think Prabhupada was indicating after. But could be, I mean, then it wasn't so exclusive. He said that I initiated unqualified disciples. So from that I took it that it was especially what they were doing after. But I don't know if that's exclusive. He didn't, that's all he said, made a comment. A lot of the sins are burnt up right in the initiation fire. Depends how many attachments we're holding on to. Whatever attachments we have, those are connected to desires we have, which are connected to karmas that we have. That's why detach. As we can gradually detach ourselves, so we can cross over the illusion of the material world with the weapon of detachment. We're attached to many things, so that if we attach to things which are approved by Krishna, then it's not so dangerous. Like controlled attachment. So we try to control what we're attached to. Things that we have to have because it's part of our life, and we have our controlled attachments. And things which are superfluous, which are just unnecessary obstacles, then detach. And eventually, before we die, we have to become more detached. The best way of becoming detached, but it's very difficult to do, just in relation to the material world, it's almost impossible. But in relation to Krishna, that if we allow ourselves to become more and more attached to Krishna, then automatically we become detached. So our process is not so much of detachment and renunciation as one of attachment to Krishna. An automatic detachment. Lord Chaitanya has encouraged us, like, take Krishna, especially Prabhupada, for the Westerners. He hasn't promoted that to be a very heavy kind of renunciation, because it's completely against the nature of the Westerners. But rather, using Lord Chaitanya's process to get everyone attached to Krishna. If you're very much attached to Krishna and you have developed love for Krishna, then automatically that replaces the other attachments of the material world. Brings everything into perspective. Well, we may be in the material world, but it's not. The example is given as like the cobra, who has the poison fangs taken out. Cobra's there, but who cares? It doesn't have any teeth. The material world is there, the material objects of the senses are there, but since you're getting a much higher experience of happiness, it's no longer a problem. You can deal with it. That's why devotees have to keep strong. They have to keep tasting. They have to keep avoiding offenses. Because it's like our protection, it's like vaccination. It's the spiritual antibody to be always in bliss. If we lose that bliss, then we become, it's like susceptible to the attack. It's like getting spiritual AIDS. We do a lot of offenses and we lose our protection. We can get any kind of disease. Any material spiritual disease could attack us. There's no more protection. Therefore, that's why it's so important to chant. Maybe someone does good service, has a good service attitude, but without the chanting, they may not be so protected. Whether they can sustain it or not. Theoretically, if they always do service, they never commit any offenses, they can get back. But practically, because it's so difficult to maintain the proper attitude, the chanting is recommended in this age. So since we don't chant all the time, when we're not chanting, we do service, we do other devotional activities. Yes?
When you're talking about seniority, this made me think, who is more senior? Someone's been in the room for a long time, who doesn't have an initiation, or a young Brahma? It's just in there.
Well, I know in sannyas that a sannyasi is senior, even if he's initiated. Maybe he's initiated later than somebody, but if he took sannyas first, he's considered senior. Never discussed about the brahminical initiation as a. But this kind of, we don't really work on hierarchy, I mean, that kind of seniority so much. I was living in the Gaudiya Math when I first went to India, because there was no ISKCON temple. And they're really into that. Like, they asked me whether I was first or second initiated, what year I got initiated, what day, what month, and then what month, what day. Then they figured out exactly, everybody sits in line according to their seniority. You don't just sit down for prasadam, anywhere. You have to sit in the row. So I fit in, where I fit in, I sit here. So maybe I have to ask the girl, in ISKCON we haven't been so particular about that. So I'll be. As a Brahmin, you want to pull rank on somebody? Well, I'm just foreseeing the future. Probably the more Vaishnava. Even if somebody was, if one someone was senior, even if they were not a Brahmin, you'd probably still treat them somewhat respectfully, just because they're around longer. A brahmana takes more responsibility by taking the brahmana initiation. So, as a brahmana, they also do respect. If the non-brahmana, even though he's older, offends the brahmana, then he can be a brahmana aparad. But even if somebody's younger, I mean, we deal differently, but we should never try to offend anybody. It says that, I read in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that Uttamadhikari, advanced to Lodi in topmost level, if he somehow obstructs and offends the spiritual life of a neophyte, he can fall down from his position. You had to be, just because someone may be senior doesn't mean he can actually offend other people. He should be more careful by his experience, be more careful not to offend anybody. But it was like, I was in the room once with Srila Prabhupada, we were visiting Sridhar Swami of the Gaudiya Mutt, Sridhar Maharaj. And one of his young brahmacharis came down and invited the prasad, was where they were guests for the prasad. And then Prabhupada was seated in the guest room. And then Prabhupada was starting to move, you know, to go for the king prasad. But then the brahmachari just said, "Oh, you don't have tilak." You know, like, you should put on your tilak. It was just so upstarting, you know. It was just like, you know. Then Prabhupada just looked at him and said, "I'm a Paramahamsa, I don't need to lie." Put him down. Anyway, then Prabhupada couldn't feel like anyway. Yes?
I was just, you're talking about the holy name, and last night you're talking about other Judeo-Christian religions with the holy name, recognizing different holy names. And the question just came up about the Judeo-Christian traditions of not recognizing the form of God. I was wondering how, you know, if you could enlighten us how that came about. That
I don't know. It has to. That's another. I don't know. That's the history of religion. My impression was it was something fairly recent. That in Christianity we always heard Jesus talk about God as the Father, with very personal attributes. But I don't know the history of the different, there's so many thousands. And I think they did a study in America, how many Christian groups are there? It was like 16,000 or something. It's like so many kinds of... So which ones are impersonalists? I don't have a clue. But I met some impersonal priests. I have a disciple who's a nun. She told me there's some priests who are atheists, which is pretty amazing. They do it because they like the social work. But they don't actually believe in God. Just a nice job, low, you know, few hours. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised maybe in the future some devotees become priests because good job, good pay. Some priests become devotees, so why not devotees become priests? There's some Anglican priests that chant japa and worship deities. They just have to change the jargon when they give the sermon. Anyway, that's another topic. But I don't know all the history. Somebody who studies, I know I have a disciple in South America who's studying history, but not the history of religions, just generally, but history is a very important topic. He may, I can ask him, he may know. if there's it's more like an interfaith question, but it's like in Islam, generally everybody's impersonalist. They all feel like Allah doesn't have a form. But in Chaitanya Charitamrita, when Lord Chaitanya is discussing with the peers, he establishes through the Quran that actually Allah is a person. And in the Hadith, which is not as the Hadith is the Quran was like spoken by Muhammad when he was in trance, and Hadith is when he was like not in trance, but like histories about him, like Lilamrita or something. So the one day he came late for the morning prayer. He's never late for prayer. He's like never missed a mandalakti, never missed a namaz. So he was late, and then he came for the next prayer, 7 or whatever, and or 7. He was a little late, so he said, apologized for being late. He said that after the morning prayer, I was in meditation and I kind of went into a trance, and then I had this vision where Allah came and put his hand on my shoulder. I looked down and I could see his fingers. When I woke up, I realized I'm late for prayers, so I came, so I'm sorry. So he says that. So Allah's got fingers. Was he a person? Or, you know, but people still, Muhammad said, I don't know how they brush that one away. There's a few things like that that very clearly understand. Plus, all of what Chaitanya said, Allah's all merciful, compassionate. When I was in Christianity, I never met anybody that personally told me that God wasn't a person. Since I've been in Krishna consciousness, I've talked to so many people, and priests and different people, that I find that now it's quite popular. Maybe it's the infiltration of Buddhism into Christianity or something, or Advaita. But I don't know where it comes from. And now being in India, I meet less Christians than Muslims. There's more Muslims in India than Christians. But this one Catholic priest came up to see me in Mayapur, and then we were talking. He was from Kerala. And then I said, well, we're trying to achieve the first commandment of Jesus, to love thy Lord thy God with all thy heart, thy soul, and mind. And he made like a face. He says, I'm not into that. And he said, the second commandment is as good as the first. And I'm like, just, you know, it's just not, although it's second, but it's really just the same. So, I mean, God is like so inaccessible. We can serve the people. So I'm just into serving the people. This love of God is not relevant. I don't think it's relevant to us anymore. He's a Catholic priest. Where do you go from that? So we have a lot. Our devotees need to really learn the philosophy very well, be very well grounded in this. We could contribute to other religions who are really lost focus on even what their own religions have taught them. But to do that, we have to first thoroughly know our own tradition and philosophy, and then you study theirs, and then from that point you can see how we can contribute something to their, whether it's lacking. My mother chants Hare Krishna, and she's a devout Christian. And she doesn't have any problem. She sees that Krishna's name of God, God the Father. So she's found that reading Bhagavad Gita and Krishna consciousness helped her. But she's very attached from her birth to Jesus, so she worships Jesus. Like you have, I've seen, what's it called? Jews for Jesus. Like people where some of there's a group like that. The future may have, like, you know, Krishna Christians. People that chant Hare Krishna, worship Krishna, but they're still attached to Jesus. May have people like that. It's hard to say where, if we could do a lot of preaching, and so many things can happen.